Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today on the program, we explore the concept of selling out with a researcher who says you don't have to give up on all your principles, but you might need to compromise. Also, an exploration of Victorian mourning rituals with Siouxland Public Media's former general manager, Gretchen Gondek. But first, some good news for farmers. After months of haggling, the U.S. Senate is one step closer to approving the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal. Yesterday, the Senate Finance Committee, chaired by Republican Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, voted 25-3 to approve the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. Grassley's been eager to put the deal to a vote and has repeatedly criticized Democrats in the House for taking months to approve it and send it on to the Senate. Grassley and other farm state senators applauded the potential for the new agreement to help farmers and ranchers by providing more marketplace certainty for their exports. The USMCA adds provisions for digital technologies that mostly didn't exist in the NAFTA era of the mid-1990s. The leaders of Mexico, Canada, and the United States signed the new deal on November 30th of 2018. Mexico ratified it in June of last year, and the U.S. House approved it last month. It still needs a vote from the full U.S. Senate and Canadian ratification before it goes into effect. The timeline for a full Senate vote remains uncertain, though, because of the pending impeachment trial for President Donald Trump. As Iowa counts down to the first in the nation February 3rd presidential caucuses, new poll numbers show a tight race among the leading candidates. A recent poll by CBS News shows a three-way tie between Democratic candidates Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, and Pete Buttigieg. Each has 23% support. In fourth place, Elizabeth Warren has 16%, and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar holds at 7% support. Former Democratic Massachusetts Senator John Kerry was in Sioux City yesterday pledging his support for former Vice President Joe Biden. It's part of the We Know Joe tour, with surrogates speaking out to support Biden. However, the one-time presidential candidate was interrupted early on in his presentation by protesters who were carrying signs saying Palestinians should be free. However, the former Secretary of State was gracious, telling protesters he believed in freedom of speech. As the noise died down, Kerry went on to tell the crowd of about 100 people at the Joe Biden headquarters on Hamilton Boulevard in Sioux City that Biden deserves their support because he can defeat President Donald Trump this fall.
That Joe Biden is the one person in this race who has the heart and the instinct and the record, the experience and the ability to make certain that we win the presidency in 2020.
Kerry also spoke out against President Trump for his order to kill Iranian General Qasem Soleimani last week.
Was that absolutely the thing to do now, at this moment? Was that the only choice we had? Did we have other ways? And what were the repercussions going to be?
Kerry said that Joe Biden has the experience on the international stage to make hard decisions that could affect Americans. Kerry continues his tour of Iowa today in support of Biden. In addition to Sioux City, the We Know Joe tour will visit Missouri Valley, Council Bluffs, Adel, Des Moines, Fort Dodge, Algona, Mason City, Muscatine, Davenport, Clinton, Dubuque, and Webster City. Minnesota U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar talked with potential caucus goers last Friday at Sioux City's Orpheum Theater. Klobuchar said her campaign was surging and said she had raised more than $1 million the day after the December 19th presidential debate. The Minnesota U.S. Senator told supporters at the Orpheum Theater that the financial boost has meant a lot to her campaign.
After that last debate, we raised over $1 million in small contributions within 24 hours. So we're seeing a total surge that's allowed us to double our staff in the state of Iowa.
Klobuchar said her campaign is also adding staff in early voting states like South Carolina, Nevada, and New Hampshire. Klobuchar said she was running in part because she believes there has not been shared prosperity in America.
You have seen those vigorous debates that we've had on the stage about things like health care and my view that we need a nonprofit a public option that's going to bring down the costs, and my view that we need to really take on the pharmaceutical companies in a big way to bring those prices down. We know there's issues with the rural economy, many of which are Donald Trump's making. We know all these problems.
Klobuchar talked about the Affordable Care Act, saying it's received a lot of criticism. But she adds, it wasn't really meant to be an answer to everyone's healthcare problems on arrival.
I figure, as I said when we passed it, and I had worked on it hard, it was a beginning and not an end. There were things that weren't resolved in that bill. The first is a nonprofit public option. That would create enormous competition in terms of getting some of the premium rates down, and it would also immediately allow for more people to be covered. That's the first thing. The second thing that you can do is things like reinsurance and cost sharing, something that has been tried and done very well in states like Minnesota and Alaska.
Klobuchar also talked about making accommodations for what she calls the silver surge, or the large numbers of seniors that will make up the population in the next 10 to 20 years. She says keeping Social Security strong is a big part of providing a safety net for older Americans. Klobuchar proposes creating a donut hole in Social Security for seniors with higher incomes. She also wants to do more to make prescription drugs more affordable. Klobuchar said she has talked to farmers who voted for President Trump in 2016 who are fed up with the agriculture and trade policies he has instituted since. She answered a question from the crowd about recovering from President Trump's trade war. Klobuchar said the country needed consistent trade policies.
This guy does tweets at 4 a.m. and there's a saying about trade policy, keep your promises and keep your threats. He does neither. I think he should go back and negotiate with the Chinese. I think we do it better when we're with our allies. I think we do better when we are in a North American trading bloc.
Klobuchar said it was important to stay in touch with all kinds of voters in Iowa, many of them who may not have been approached by Democratic candidates so far.
And we cannot shut out people. There are 31 counties in Iowa that voted for Barack Obama and then turned around and voted for Trump. There are people out there in 2016 in our own fired up Democratic base, and you know them, that stayed home. They didn't want to vote. Or there are people that voted independent, voted for someone else. Or there are people, yes, that voted for him. There are moderate Republicans out there that see the problems with the ag economy right now and see what's to come, that want to make a difference. But overall, this is about a values check. It is a decency check.
Klobuchar also talked about the need to put more money in K-12 public education and post-secondary education as well.
What that means, it means 1 and 2 year degrees. Make those free because they're the fastest growing area that we have right now. Double the Pell Grants for 4 year degrees. Of course, we have needs for 4 year degrees and beyond, but let's target those resources for both public and private colleges by doubling that money up to $12,000 instead of $6,000 that you can get a year. And then let's make sure it goes up to families that make up to $100,000 a year instead of just $50,000.
And Klobuchar, like most of the Democratic presidential candidates, is calling for comprehensive immigration reform.
Immigrants don't diminish America. They are America. And certainly, certainly you know this in this community. We need workers in our fields and in our factories. And how you do this? Comprehensive immigration reform. Your Senator Chuck Grassley voted for it, along with me, in 2013. We had a bill. We can always make it a little better, but we had a good bill. It was supported by the AFL-CIO. Why? Because workers were in the underground economy, and it was bringing down wages. It was supported by the Chamber. It was supported by the Farm Bureau, Farm Union, and, yes, the migrant worker groups. Why? Because people saw it as an economic necessity.
Klobuchar also said it was time to hold lawmakers' feet to the fire when it comes to universal background checks for purchasing firearms. And two more presidential candidates, these with single-digit support, visited Siouxland recently. Billionaire hedge fund manager Tom Steyer spoke to a crowd of about 100 people at the Sioux City Convention Center Thursday, January 2nd. Steyer is a major critic of President Donald Trump, and he shared his thoughts on the commander-in-chief with the group who attended his campaign event.
He said to people in Washington, D.C., American citizens, you don't like me. And I don't like you. But you're all going to vote for me because if the Democrats get into power, they're going to destroy the economy in about 15 minutes. So here's what I think he's literally, this is going to be his campaign for president. Is going to be, I'm a criminal. You all know that. I hate 80% of Americans. You know that. Your mom would never let me in the front door. You know that. But you're going to vote for me because I'll save the economy. And the socialists in the Democratic Party don't know what they're doing. And the question is, we're going to have to beat that on the debate stage in the fall of 2020. And this is a guy whose history is that he can take down conventional politicians. I mean, think back to 2016. There were 16 conventional Republican politicians on the stage, and he just mopped the floor with them. And then we put up the most prepared candidate in American history. I mean, she'd been a senator, she'd been the Secretary of State, she'd been the First Lady. She was the most prepared candidate ever, and he managed to beat her too. So we're going to have somebody who can get on the stage with this bully and take him down on his strength, the economy. And that is what I can do. That is, I can do that. Because I've said it in my ads. You've probably heard me say it on the air. I've had 8-year-old kids come up to me and go, fraud and failure. And it's true. He is a fraud and a failure. He was a fake business person. He played a business person on a reality TV show. And he's been a terrible, look, we're in Iowa. He has been terrible to the people of the United States economically, but he's been especially terrible to the people of Iowa. You know, his tax plan is the single worst piece of economic legislation I've ever seen. $1 trillion giveaway to the richest people and the biggest corporations that you know is going to come out of the hide of working Americans in the future. It's really the worst piece of economic legislation ever. And he has a trade war that has been a complete failure that specifically hurt American workers and killed American farmers. It's failed. I would end the trade war literally on the first day. I would just say, it's a mistake. We're rescinding the whole thing. Could we please forget he ever existed? Honestly. And the other thing, look, he has the wrong idea about what prosperity looks like. If the country grows, but only 1% of America profits from it, does that growth even matter? If your wages aren't keeping up with your costs, is that really prosperity? And if there's no ability to move within society, if there's no mobility, if you can't live the American dream, that's a failed society. That is what he is offering Americans. And the real point is, can we go and look through his loud voice and his bullying and tell the truth about what's been going on in America, which is a 40-year war against working people? That's really what we have to do. That's what someone has to be able to take him on the stage, because he's actually attacking the things that make Americans prosperous and successful. Things like education, the things that allow people to be healthy, healthcare. He is doing things that are absolutely bad for Americans, and someone has to expose him and stand up to him and make him stand down, and I promise I can do that.
And that was Democratic candidate for President Tom Steyer, who was in Sioux City last week. He is a billionaire hedge fund manager. And former Maryland Congressman John Delaney was in town last week as well. He has a goal to visit 40 different communities before the Iowa caucuses on February 3rd. Delaney made a stop in Sioux City Sunday, January 5th. He talked to Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer
before a stop at Horizon Restaurant.
Because the issues I'm running on are what matter to Iowans, particularly rural Iowans. I've been to all 99 counties. I've done more events than any candidate in the state of Iowa. And I'm the only one really talking about the issues that matter to rural Iowa. And that's probably my background is different. You know, I'm a blue-collar kid, first in my family to go to college. I was a successful entrepreneur, started two businesses, created thousands of jobs, and then served in the Congress. So Iowans should caucus for me if they want a leader who's got a track record of getting things done, and if they want someone who's really going to fight and fight hard for rural America.
Now, I know looking at the polls, you're towards the bottom.
Yes.
What do you think you can do to help improve that before we head into February 3rd?
Well, for the next month, I'm doing what I call the Send a Message Tour, where I'm doing 40 stops in small towns all around Iowa. And my point to these communities is, listen, I'm the only one showing up. I'm the only one talking about bringing jobs, entrepreneurships, innovation, and investments into rural communities. It's one of the central challenges this country faces is how these small towns are shrinking and aging, and there's a lack of opportunity for young people. And if you, small town Iowa, think these issues matter, you need to send a message to the Democratic Party in the country by caucusing for someone who's going to fight for you. Because I promise if I do better on caucus day than people think, when I get in front of television cameras, I'm going to say the only reason I'm here is because rural Iowa sent a message that their issues matter and we have to pay attention to them. So that's really my strategy. I'm asking rural Iowa to help me help them.
I noticed that some of your Democratic opponents, you kind of do have a different viewpoint. Maybe you're more of a centralist than some of them. Do you think that will help in courting the Iowans to the caucuses?
Yeah, because, for example, I am more of a moderate, which doesn't mean I don't want to do big things. I want to do huge things. But I also believe in this sense of pragmatism, that you have to work together to get things done, that this corrosive, divisive partisanship that we've lived in the last couple of decades is really hurting our country. Last night I was in Dune, Iowa, which is a great small town, and I was having a meet and greet, a dinner, with a bunch of Democrats. And about 15 or 20 diehard Trump supporters joined us. And I invited them to join us and sit down with us. And so they actually outnumbered the Democrats. And we had a great conversation. They were pushing me hard on a bunch of issues. We didn't agree on everything. But to a person, when they left, one person said they would actually vote for me. And the other people told my wife, April, who's with me, they're like, you know, I respect him. He's honest. He's straightforward. He speaks the truth. You know, I'm still with Trump, but I could see voting for someone like that as a Democrat. And I think, you know, in small communities, and then all the Democrats and Trump supporters, then they all like hung out afterwards, like they were all friends. And the point is, we can find common ground. I obviously disagree with the president on a whole bunch of things and think he has not done a good job as our president. But that doesn't mean I can't find common ground with people who support him and get him on my team.
Why do you think there is such a divide now, though, between Republicans and Democrats in Washington? I mean, it seems more dire. It seemed, you know, in the past, people could work together.
Yeah, it's really getting dangerous. I would say it's a couple things. Number one, how people get information has changed, as you know. And increasingly, there's the ability of people to get information through filtered sources and not have a broad perspective. So we got to adjust to that. We actually got to pass some laws around these social media companies. That's another discussion. But we need different leaders. We need leaders who act like half the country is not entirely wrong about everything they believe. Because right now, we've actually had leaders who basically say, if you're not in my party, you're wrong about everything. And that's just created this horrible, divisive culture. And so the only way out of this is with leadership. Leadership that's committed every single day to try to do something to bring the country together.
When it comes to leadership, this past week, the big story, of course, is what happened mm-hmm. with the Iranian general. What do you think Iran will do next?
Well, I think Iran will retaliate. And, as an American, I hope that the retaliation is something we can avoid and we can de-escalate and that it's not significant. But I think they will obviously try to do something. And maybe just for show, it may not be a big deal, or hopefully it's not something really bad. I mean, look, at my view of what happened is as follows. The world is better off without this person. You know, he's got more blood on his hands of American troops than anyone. I can't speak to the intelligence that the president and his team saw that told them that they should do this attack. You know, I haven't seen it, and I think we shouldn't prejudge it. But I do know what he didn't do is he didn't consult congressional leaders, and he didn't consult our allies like Great Britain, who's been with us every step of the way in the Middle East. And they have troops on the ground right side by side with us in the Middle East. And I thought his failure to consult with Congress and his failure to consult with a few world leaders, which would have taken 5 or 10 minutes, shows his reckless leadership. Because if you actually are the leader, the commander-in-chief that this country needs, and you're always trying to make the absolute best decision whenever you deploy our military, why wouldn't you spend 5 minutes consulting the four leaders in Congress and 2 or 3 of our allies just to get their opinion on the matter? You don't have to listen to it, but it just shows a kind of hubris and arrogance that you don't even need to talk to those people. So that's my perspective.
That's former Maryland Congressman John Delaney. He's one of many Democrats still running for president. Delaney grew up in a blue-collar family in New Jersey and received his law degree from Georgetown before launching 2 multi-million dollar companies. Listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Yesterday, the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors began a new weekly routine to air the latest information about a possible $49 million jail referendum in March. The supervisors, for the next 2 months in each of their weekly Tuesday afternoon meetings, will share key financial and other statistics about the jail that's planned by county officials, but which can't be built unless a public referendum passes. The supervisors say there should be a concerted effort to inform the public about the jail. The board made that announcement a week ago after one supervisor, Jeremy Taylor, said the referendum should be delayed from March to September. None of the other 4 supervisors want that delay, but they say the latest jail information will be shared. The vote timing could officially be set after 3 meetings next week. I spoke with Jeremy Taylor at the courthouse just before yesterday's board meeting. Taylor said he would like to give county residents time to review the voluminous amount of research that has already been done on the current and future needs of the jail.
With a committee and different stakeholders from the jail, mental health providers, folks in the business community, and others who represent taxpayers. And so we want to not only show our over 800 pages of notes and meeting minutes, but also really lay out the reasons why this may very well make sense. But to do so, I believe, at an earlier date, I don't believe is going to give the public as much time to be able to digest the material and the information that we have. And so that's why I am a lone voice so far saying that we need to put this on as a referendum potentially much later rather than earlier.
Taylor said he believed people needed more information about what was going on with the jail.
And they have to understand some of the studies that we've done. I've heard people say, well, just add on or just replace the HVAC system in place or do so when it's the fall or spring and you could shut down the system. Those are not possibilities. People have to understand that we have a jail that was built for 1987, and that now has 234. When that HVAC system is shut down, all of those inmates need to go someplace. And there are not places that can wholly house 234. So in doing an HVAC replacement, because there was some poor planning, I believe, in 1987, in which there are no redundancies for that system, We are going to realize almost $3 million just in transporting inmates and paying other counties and entities to house them and then to bring them back for trial during that 90-day replacement period. If you add that along with the fact that it was built over a former gas station and we are at about $1 million in benzene remediation and all of the other factors, whether or not it makes sense.
Do you feel that there's a need to get going on this sooner rather than later because of some of the things you just talked about?
I think that that is a distinct possibility. My worry is there's an old mantra, do it right, but not right now. In other words, if the public believes that by putting this on and voting in mid-January is too soon and that they don't have enough information, I think that that may not bode as well as if we took a little more time in explaining.
Do you think this is the kind of thing people might say, well, I don't want to vote for anything that's going to increase my taxes?
Yes, I do. I think that's a concern. It's a nearly $50 million project. That's a reason that last week I talked about a taxpayer protection plan, by which I mean this facility is being built with a capacity of nearly 440 inmates. And I told you we currently have about 234. The reason is that if it is built at a greater capacity, not only will it be some foresight to have room so that we're not in the same predicament in the future, but it also relies on federal prisoners, ICE detainees, for which the federal government could help to contribute revenue that would otherwise not be taxpayer funded. That would be great theoretically over the next 20 years. If those revenues aren't there and they will not give us a guarantee, then it becomes a question for me of how do we protect taxpayers? What are we going to do as a county to give them some assurance that this isn't going to be a $50 million tax increase? So I have a plan that I put before the other supervisors last week and in which we would have a moratorium on other capital infrastructure projects where future CF revenues past 2030 would be able to be realized and some other provisions. It'll have to be decided at least 46 days before the opportunity in March or September. There's only statutorily two dates that that can happen. And so that'll be as soon as January 17th, I believe, is the date that the supervisors and the joint authority would have to give assent to putting it on the ballot for mid-March.
That was Woodbury County Supervisor Jeremy Taylor talking about his idea to push back the referendum on building a new $49 million Woodbury County jail. The supervisors don't hold the actual power to set the vote date, as another entity with that clout is aiming for the referendum to be held on March 3rd. Support for The Exchange comes from Gregory Giles, investment advisor representative with Legacy Financial LLC in Sioux City, serving the financial planning and investment needs of clients since 2004. Information about Legacy Financial and Greg Giles is available at www.legacyfinancialllc.com. Securities offered through United Planners Financial Services, member FINRA, SIPC. Financial planning and advisory services offered through RDA Financial Network. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. State lawmakers are getting back to work. Nebraska legislators began work this week, and Iowa and South Dakota lawmakers will convene next week. Tax relief is a big concern to lawmakers in all three states, and agricultural issues will also be on the docket. In South Dakota, a coalition is hoping a bill that would legalize the growing of industrial hemp would be acceptable to Republican Governor Kristi Noem this year. House Republican leader Lee Quam is a farmer and rancher who chairs the legislature's Industrial Hemp Study Committee.
Last year, we had a bill to okay the growing of hemp in South Dakota. It passed the House by a large margin. It has passed the Senate by a large margin. And it ended up that the governor vetoed it because she was just had some concerns with it. How do we tell the difference between marijuana and hemp and, you know, issues like that? So we're not able to override the veto. So this summer we have had meetings all summer long to talk with different people, different states about how they're dealing with the hemp and what's happening in their states, if they're having any problems with the hemp and the marijuana. And so we came up with another bill. It's not a whole lot different than the one we had. It's pretty basic. It's patterned after the bill in Kentucky. And we will be presenting that again. The governor has stated that she will veto the bill again. But there's some dialogue taking place. There's some things that are happening that she's starting to feel more comfortable with it. So we will see what happens as we move along.
Why do you think hemp would be such a good thing for farmers in South Dakota to be able to grow and market?
I think it's another option. It's the first new crop we've had in 70, 80 years. Back in the 40s, hemp used to be growing all over. It was a very viable product. When you look at everything that you can do with hemp, 17,000 different products can be made out of hemp. You have the CBD oil, you have hempcrete, you have hemp boards. There's so many different things. It's extremely versatile, and I think there's opportunity for farmers as well as manufacturers to come into the state of South Dakota, set up shop, and we grow business together. So that's what I'm kind of excited about is the ability for the hemp production to grow as well as the processors coming in and growing, making two things happen at once.
Isn't there a tribe? Wasn't the Oglala Sioux get an opportunity to grow hemp? That's a separate thing though, right?
Well, it's the same thing, but the tribes are their own sovereign nation, so they have the ability to grow hemp regardless of what the state does. Flandreau, the tribe of Flandreau, has been okayed to grow hemp, and actually Standing Rock, which is up in the northeast part of the state, grew some through North Dakota because the tribal ground extends into North Dakota, so they actually grew some last year. So the tribes are able to do it regardless of what the state does, and also an individual producer like myself, if we don't get it through the state, if I wanted to go out on my own and do it, I could get an okay from USDA to grow it.
That was Lee Quam. He's the House Republican leader in the South Dakota legislature. He's a farmer and rancher who chairs the legislature's Industrial Hemp Study Committee. He was talking about the latest bill that would legalize hemp production and growth in South Dakota. The proposed bill for the 2020 session will require permits from the state and background checks for owner-operators before they can grow hemp, and anyone in possession of hemp without a permit could be charged with a felony. The state's hemp program will also be separate from the 9 tribes in South Dakota, who are considered separate entities when it comes to USDA approval of their hemp programs. Hemp production is now legal in Iowa and also in Nebraska. Listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Often when we start a new year, we take a look at our values and consider whether we have been able to live up to them, and this can be a difficult thing for a lot of us to do. However, a new book says we may be doing ourselves a disservice for being too judgmental about our ability to follow all of our values to the letter. In the book, The Ethical Sellout, authors Lily Zhang and Inga Hansen make the bold claim that everyone sells out, and the real challenge lies in doing so ethically. I spoke with co-author Inga Hansen.
Often when people say selling out, it gets really fear-based, right? Because we're thinking of these dramatic stories that you see in the news or comments that people make, you know, if it's a politician who's changing their tactic based on lobbyists who have a lot of money, or an artist who maybe starts out having like creating work that really feels true and authentic to themselves, and then they start thinking about commercializing and things like that. And so I think in that sense, selling out's often thought of as being a traitor or a liar or something like that. And we're thinking of it more, like you said, in the everyday. So it's actually this more of a nuanced decision-making process in the face of what I see as some really difficult choices, right? So that can look more like if you're proud of your identity or ethnic heritage and value supporting your family, but then you also need to dial down your identity to get ahead at work. What do you do in a situation like that? And so I think there can be all these smaller decisions that we make in the day-to-day that are actually selling out decisions, even if we don't always think of them as such.
I remember the first time I thought about, you know, the selling out, when it really occurred to me, when I saw the movie The Big Chill, where they had the whole group of people from, they were in college in the 60s and 70s, and they're all very wealthy and doing quite well now. And they sit around saying, you know, wow, you know, do you think that we've sold out? Do you think that we're not the people that we were? And they spend, because their friend dies, they spend the whole weekend talking about this.
Yeah. And I think that that situation is relatable to so many of us, right? That we might have these ideals or ideas of who we're going to be and who we want to be. And at some point in our life, there can be a reckoning between, oh, this is what I aspired to, or these are what my values are. And then this is the life that I'm actually living, especially if you've chosen financial security, or you've chosen certain kind of things to support your family or to get ahead in terms of work. I think that can really raise those questions and concerns about, did I leave my values or ideals along the way somewhere? And I think that can come up also with identity. One of the things that, I've heard some of my colleagues say, for instance, women in the workplace talking about how they needed to mask some parts of themselves in order to be able to be accepted and respected at work, but it didn't feel like they always were able to bring up issues around discrimination or harassment or things like that, or even just lift up their female colleagues because they needed to watch out for themselves. And one of them, I remember telling me that she kept telling herself that by the time she reached a certain level, then she'd be able to do that, right? She's like, okay, well, when I just get promoted to this level, just when I become a boss or an executive, then I can really advance women's rights in the workplace. And then I can really look out for my female colleagues and so on. And then she realized that that time never really happened, you know, that she got to the place that she had envisioned. And then she looked back and then she was too afraid of trying to keep it to be able to take any risks at that time. And so it does raise questions for us, you know, when we're really going to meet our ideals. And if we can't, if we're in a situation where we have to compromise, then how do we reconcile that? And is there a way to do that ethically?
In the book, you talk about the whole idea of selling out ethically, or an ethical sellout.
So I think that was one of the things that was really interesting to my co-author and I, is getting away from the idea of just, okay, are you a sellout or not? And then more thinking about, well, if we all compromise or we all sell out in some ways, how can we make that process more ethical? And what are some of the skills that we might be able to use to help make that process thoughtful and more as in line with our values as possible? And so one of the things that we did is we put together a few different skills that we felt really are a part of making these decisions ethically. And so a few of those include being compassionate. And I think this one, it stands out to people as a little surprising, because I think we commonly think of, well, if you're compromising or selling out in some way, you should absolutely feel bad about it and you should be judging it. But that's usually happening for us already, right? Where we tend to be really down on ourselves and thinking that we're terrible people for making these decisions. But actually, we can be helped by being compassionate with ourselves around the context that led us into that situation and got us there, and also compassionate with the others around us who might be in those situations themselves. And also along those lines, being really honest with ourselves. Again, it's honest about not just toward others with why we're doing what we're doing or what we're actually doing motivationally, but honest with ourselves about why we're making the decisions that we're making and what's the real motivation behind it. It's hard to be ethical unless you're being clear with yourself what your true motivations are and what you're hoping to achieve. And another one, I won't go through all the skills that we talk about, but another one is accountability, which we see as important in the sense of accountability often gets kind of this negative association, right? If somebody says, I'm going to hold you accountable for that, that almost never means something good. And it's often thought of as something that's just kind of a pure reaction after the fact that comes from others. But one of the ways that we want to look at it is as a positive. It's a way of being reliable. It's a way of staying closer to your values and something that can actually be front-loaded in the beginning if you know that you might be heading down a slippery path in decisions that you're making moving forward.
So is this talking about sort of the issue of compromise?
So I see selling out as a type of compromise. I think that compromise can mean so many different things, but that in this situation, it's a compromise that has to do with our values or ideals, right? That we might be in a situation where, you know, often in this world, we're told to follow your moral compass or lead a values-driven life. But if you're in a situation where your values or ideals are in conflict with each other, or your values and ideals are in conflict with your needs, then something ends up needing to bend or compromise in order to move forward, right? And so when you're in a situation where something related to your values might need to be compromised, then how do you think through a situation like that where you're not just throwing everything away, but you're actually compromising or bending the minimum amount necessary to survive?
That was Inga Hansen. She and Lily Zhang are the authors of the book, The Ethical Sellout: Maintaining Your Integrity in the Age of Compromise. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. This Sunday in Sioux City, you can go back in time and find out what it was like to mourn a loved one in the Victorian era. Gretchen Gondek sat down with Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer and talked about a piece of Victorian history and a special program she's hosting this weekend at the Betty Strong Encounter Center.
And for about 30 to, I would say, 45 minutes, beginning at 2 o'clock, we're going to be visiting about mourning, and that's M-O-U-R-I-N-G, rituals in Victorian America. Of course, this all began with the death of Albert, who was husband to Queen Victoria, who, my goodness, she ruled for 63 years. Do you believe that? Isn't that amazing?
I know. She was the longest running monarch until Queen Elizabeth.
Absolutely.
I believe so.
Yes. And when Albert died, she was the moral authority. So what she did mattered. And it mattered so much, a lot of those rituals and things that people did in Victorian England kind of spilled over into the culture of American life and death as well. So there were things like you would put black over the mirror. You would cover the mirror.
Like completely cover it.
Completely cover it so that the spirit of the departed would not be trapped within the mirror. There were all kinds
wow.
of, yeah.
There, but mirrors are pretty important because that, you know, they were modern technology at one time.
Right.
You know, we take them for granted now, but to have one of those, I would think that you would have to have a little bit more money than maybe most people, right?
And
I'm
you know,
guessing.
Exactly. There were levels, you know, based on your economic wherewithal about what you could afford to do. But of course, if you were in the wealthy class, you did all of the rituals, which included a magnificent funeral, you know, the appropriate music, what you wore. I mean, women would literally be subjected to wearing black for at least a year. And if you lost a child, you wore white ribbons. There were very specific things that you were supposed to do for protocol. And if you didn't observe these rules, it was quite scandalous.
It was. Well, yeah. You always had to be careful what you were doing. Nowadays, you know, you can do whatever you want. Most people, for the most part, usually leave you alone. But back then, yeah, you always had to worry about what other people were thinking. And also, when you were talking about the rituals, were there a certain kind of like the music they even had to dictate? Were there certain things that, what kind of music would you hear?
You would hear, and of course, this was during the American Civil War. So, and I think on the PBS Civil War soundtrack, that the documentary by Ken Burns, there's Weeping, Sad, and Lonely. There's a lot of tunes that appropriate for mourning, and there are a specific set of songs and tunes for children as well, very different from what we just discussed. It's an interesting time. The coffins, there was the toe pincher coffin.
What is that? Where
it would narrow to the feet.
Oh, but that's what we think of when, you know, you watch a Dracula movie.
Exactly.
Or something that's kind of scary. Was there a reason why it was that shape?
I think they just, there were options. You could vary.
You could pick.
And, you know, that was considered fashionable. And then you could have a plate put over the face of the departed. You could even leave the departed in their coffin if you had the wherewithal financially and visit the mausoleum and watch them deteriorate.
That was fashionable?
It was fashionable if you could afford to do that. Yeah.
And that actually today seems quite morbid, doesn't it?
Well, a lot of this stuff by our standards really is morbid. And in fact, speaking of morbid, there's a whole thing about hair.
Oh, yeah. Hair art is such a thing. I know my aunt bought recently historic, you know, artwork with hair, but there's really kind of a different meaning behind it. I mean, it might look kind of quirky or kind of beautiful to some people, but it actually kind of had a meaning for some others, too, and from what I understand.
Women would do this in the home, so they would collect the hair. And, of course, for children, quite often they would have a photograph of the child and then something that looked like a branch or a cross. But the closer you look, and I have one of these, it's hair, and it's intricate, and it is beautifully, beautifully done. So women would do this out of respect and as a symbol of remembrance for their loved one. And of course, infant mortality rates were very high, not only in America, but in Victorian England. So this was a way to remember and honor your beloved.
Yeah, it's something you can keep forever. Because we do occasionally, you know, I think I still have the hair from my daughter's first haircut. I don't know what you're going to do with that someday, but you can say, hey, here's your hair from way back then. But this is something they actually would put on display.
And I think, you know, most of us have a clip of hair in our baby books. And of course, in the 1700s, it was very common for schoolgirls to exchange locks of hair. And beyond the hair art, the departed's hair was often made into a watch fob, a brooch, a locket of some kind. And this was meant, you know, very, very respectfully to have this memory of your departed one with you at all times. So it's really fascinating, but, you know, by our standards today, a little creepy.
That's true. And when we watch some of these shows, when you watch Queen Victoria on PBS, it seems so romantic and beautiful, but it was really a rough period.
It was a rough period, but, you know, it was also the romantic age. So you had literature like Frankenstein and a real interest in the fantastic. And around the mourning rituals, there were seances, there were all kinds of things where you would meet to commune with the dead spirit and just all kinds of really interesting things.
So it's kind of a heavy topic, but then you're going to end things on a light note.
Yes, we're going to have an authentic Victorian tea following the presentation, and this is absolutely free and open to the public. I'm bringing actually a couple of recipes I found in a book that are appropriate to serve at a funeral. They're actually, in addition to everything else, recipes that you would serve at the funeral. So we're going to be sampling a few of those.
And what are some of the recipes?
Well, there's mostly cakes, different kinds of cakes. And I'm kicking around a couple of ideas about that, but I'm sure they'll be delicious. We're going to have chocolate dipped strawberries. We're going to have some wonderful little cookies from Sugar Shack and coffee and tea and mints and some other little surprises as well. So we hope people will come, and I think it'd be great to bring your daughter.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. She's fascinated by things. And I think sometimes when you talk about, yes, it is mourning, but if you talk about death in a way that is realistic. And I think it helps, you know, I wish that's the kind of education I had when I was younger, because you're afraid of death and it is actually part of life. And
this is true. This is true. And Victorians were not at all put off by talking about rituals and mourning and death, because it was so ever present in that time. And, you know, everybody lost children and, you know, people, we were talking about, there wasn't antibiotics. There was not penicillin. I mean, people died of all kinds of things. Albert, Victoria's husband, died of typhoid. Imagine that.
I know. That's pretty wild, isn't it? And to think that things that you really, you know.
Just drinking water that was contaminated. And of course, the timing is great on this, because Sunday night, I think the new Victoria season starts. And of course, as we left it, Albert collapsed. So we will see how the typhoid episode plays out. But fascinating. And then Victoria will go into full-fledged mourning, and she will set the standard for the rituals that were practiced by Victorians and Americans.
Sunday should be fabulous. Your presentation, and I love Victoria. What a great show.
It's great. And like I said, the timing is perfect.
That's Gretchen Gondek, the former station manager of Siouxland Public Media. Join Gondek Sunday at the Betty Strong Encounter Center for a retrospective on the fascinating history of rituals practiced by Americans who mourned in the 19th century. For information, check out the website SiouxCityLCIC.com. That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Be sure to join us next week. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks for listening.